From the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, this is Voices of Public Intellectuals. I'm your host, Florence Ladd. This week's program features Patricia Williams, professor of law at Columbia University and author of Seeing a Colorblind Future, The Paradox of Race. The title of her talk today is From Profiling to Plastic Surgery, The Cults of Appearances in Women's Politics. Here to introduce Professor Williams is Dr. Tamara March, Dean of Educational Programs.
Good evening. I'm delighted to welcome you on behalf of the Radcliffe Seminars and the Graduate Consortium in Women's Studies. I'd like to welcome you to tonight's lecture by Patricia Williams, Professor of Law at Columbia University, and a scholar whose wisdom and wit are lauded and applauded by all who know her. Patricia Williams is a graduate of Wellesley College and of the Harvard Law School. She authors a biweekly column called The Diary of a Mad Law Professor for The Nation, and is well known for her willingness to engage a broad audience in difficult discussions on issues concerning race, justice, and the contours of civic life. As the 1997 recipient of the prestigious Reith Lectureship, Williams presented a series of five talks that were aired on the BBC. A member of the State Bar of California and the Federal Court of Appeal for the Ninth Circuit, Williams has served on numerous boards, including the Advisory Council for the Medgar Evers Center for Law and Social Justice at the City University of New York, the Board of Governors for the Society of American Law Teachers, and the board of the Now Legal Defense Education Fund. She has published widely in scholarly journals and has given emphasis to the area of race, gender, and law, as well as to the issues of legal theory and legal writing. Her books include The Alchemy of Race and Rights, published in 1991, The Rooster's Egg, published in 1995, and Seeing a Colorblind Future, The Paradox of Race, published in 1997. She was awarded the Radcliffe Graduate Medal in 1999, and it is with immense pleasure that we welcome her back to the Radcliffe Institute. Patricia Williams. Thank you.
Thank you all. It's a tremendous pleasure to be here and to be part of this quite wonderful lecture series. I'm going to wander pretty far afield, I'm afraid, tonight. I include in the question of profiling and plastic surgery and the so-called cult of appearances the question of suspect profiling, innocence profiling, racial identity, taboo, sexual politics, and political disguise. I am thinking, and this is part of a larger project, of how women are confined by stereotypes, but also how men are confined, and also how men are confined as women. Now, I think the easiest example would be, in the most literal sense of political plastic surgery that I mean for this, is the question of Linda Tripp, who didn't just have physical plastic surgery, but also underwent a kind of political media revision, a kind of political plastic surgery in the metaphoric sense, very similar to the earlier bout of the same thing, which was David Duke's plastic surgery. And just generally sort of examining the degree to which plastic surgery is certainly a women's issue in some general sense, but also the fastest growing category of recipients of plastic surgery are minorities of all sorts, and within that category are blacks. So I think about David Duke because he's also altered his deadly rhetoric to sound awfully mainstream, along with his looks. Or maybe it's that the mainstream sounds more and more like David Duke. I'm never quite sure. Anyway, I am from New York. I come to you from New York, where self-presentation is a malleable affair, and the question of identity is as easy as anything goes. If you recall, some years ago, there was a play by John Guarnet entitled Six Degrees of Separation. There's a weird way in which the current Senate race reminds me a little bit of Six Degrees of Separatism. Now, if you recall, let me just start by drawing your attention to the recent, one of the most recent police shootings. It's hard to keep up. I gather there's been another one recently. But a couple of weeks ago, police accidentally killed Patrick Dorismond, an unarmed off-duty security guard, who had angrily rebuffed the aggressive attempts of undercover officers to engage him in a drug deal. Now, the mayor, who was presumably a former altar boy, responded to the outcry by releasing sealed records of Dorismond's juvenile arrests for disorderly conduct. And Dorismond was, according to the mayor, then labeled as no altar boy. Now, in response to this, Hillary Clinton decried Giuliani's action as leading the rush to judgment, quote unquote, and in some weird way, thus very nearly echoing Giuliani's opinion of her when she called the police officers in the Giallo shooting some weeks earlier murderers. Republican supporters of Mayor Giuliani then attacked Hillary Clinton back, who was also his rival for, as you know, the New York Senate seat, by calling her a tool of the Reverend Al Sharpton, whom they called the Black David Duke. Now, David Duke, of course, is the American Jörg Haider. Now, Jörg Haider is, in turn, the Austrian neo-Nazi with whom Rudolph Giuliani recently dined and with whom he shared a podium on Martin Luther King Day, all quite coincidentally, I am sure. For his part, David Duke, who has called for the extermination of Jews and for blacks to be sent back to Africa, has affected high-mindedness. I am not a racist like Jesse Jackson, he says. Now, this might be read as a response to Jesse Jackson's once having referred to New York as, quote, Heimetown, but in reality has more to do with Duke's belief that Jackson disrespects, and I quote, equal rights for everyone in this country, even white people. Now, Jackson, if you recall, did publicly apologize for his anti-Semitic remarks, after which former New York Mayor Ed Koch says, and reiterated recently in the New York Times, we became good friends. So recently, these two friends jointly denounced Mayor Giuliani, whom Jackson described as not only mean, he is becoming mental. Now, speaking of mental, Mayor Giuliani has reportedly accepted campaign contributions from the NRA. The NRA has recently denounced gun manufacturer Smith & Wesson for, quote, running up the white flag of surrender by striking a deal with President Clinton to put safety locks on its products. You remember President Clinton. He is, according to Toni Morrison, the first black president of the United States. His wife is Hillary Clinton, who, according to Rudolph Giuliani, has accepted campaign contributions from Puffy Combs. Now, Puffy Combs, as you're probably aware, is the black Jesse Ventura. And, of course, Jesse Ventura is the bald man's Al Sharpton. But back to Al Sharpton. Whose supporters blame the David Duke characterization upon the same Republican strategists then working for President George H.W. Bush's campaign, who so effectively derailed Michael Dukakis's candidacy with the notorious Willie Horton ad. Now, some of us optimists are hopeful that in an era when Thomas Jefferson is revealed to have been the white Willie Horton, any such mudslinging will be greeted with more thoughtfulness and reserve this time around. In any event, Republican spinmeisters have their hands full these days with George Bush the Younger. In answer to questions posed by a network anchor recently, the Texas governor generously pushed the envelope of Christian Brotherhood when he said that the Nation of Islam, headed by, oh, what's his name? Yes, Louis Farrakhan, is one of the world's leading religions. So if... One of the world's greatest religions, yes. If Dan Quayle was the white Amos and Andy, then surely this qualifies George W. as Texas's Dan Quayle. Meanwhile, spinmeisters in the black community have been busy too. My favorite is the image of Rudolph Giuliani as, quote, the white Dennis Rodman, both of them sharing hot-headedness and a predilection for cross-dressing. And at a party recently, I heard Latrell Sprewell called the black Rudolph Giuliani, roughing up his coaches when they get on his nerves, yet considered by loyal diehard fans who value ends over means to be, quote, doing a good job. Now, it's such fun, this name-calling, that you could almost forget that there are real issues at stake. We used to teach civics to adolescents. Now, in an era when, by some counts, 90% of young black men in New York City can expect to be stopped or arrested by police, we teach them how to survive such encounters. We teach them how to survive in a police state. We teach them, in an odd way, exactly how to be women afraid of rape. We teach them how to dress. We teach them etiquette, as a New York police commissioner put it, as life as a suspect profile. Time magazine, in this week's edition, summarizes such advice as follows. Don't be loud. Don't reach for ID. Don't antagonize. Don't ask for a badge number or threaten to file a complaint. Do it later, whispers Time magazine in the kind of parenthetical that assumes sooner or later, somewhere or another, one's physical manifestation will be presumed innocent. And if not, then plastic surgery is always the alternative, or maybe a nice, modest veil. Now, my son was listening to a children's science program some time ago, and the host was discussing those circumstances whereby our senses trick us into certain kinds of illusions or perceptions that challenge scientifically measured data about the physical world. So, for example, one trick they described is if you put your hand on a radiator, one hand on a radiator, and the other on an ice cube, then you stick both hands in the same bucket of room temperature water, the radiator hand will feel the water is cool, the ice cube hand will feel warmth. It's the same person, the same bucket of water, same time, yet contradiction, left hand from right. Welcome to the mind-altering world of sensitized response. Each hand, one burning, one freezing, experiences a measurably constant temperature, yet the neural human computer interpreting the scientific absolute of, quote, room temperature water, nonetheless codes the sensation of temperature, warm or cool, in relation to the immediately preceding sensory stimulus. Now, I do love stuff like this, and lawyer that I am, I have tried to imagine the complications that might ensue if the experiment were conducted not with two hands of the same person, but rather with separate and congenitally litigious organisms whose burnt frozen extremities happened to find themselves simultaneously stuck in a bucket of society's middle-range bilge. It was in this empirically inclined frame of mind that the news of the last few months has impressed itself upon me. Everything from the interview in the New York Times last week of a young woman at NYU who is apparently addicted to other people's Ritalin, and then an interview of many young undergraduates at NYU of those who are addicted to speed and to drugs that are not prescribed to them. In contrast to the repeated characterization of young black men who sell cocaine, which is, again, scientifically, virtually the same drug, in very, very different terms than these young people who were not only not being arrested, but were being described quite sympathetically in terms of the stresses that they were under and the unrealistic expectations of life at a high-powered institution. And reading things like this, I keep thinking of that bucket of water, of this tension of one hand with the other. I think of my friend Marlene Archer, who was arrested in Harlem a year or so ago for driving with a suspended license. She did not follow the etiquette prescribed by Time magazine and said to the arresting officer, "You've got to be kidding." "Add resisting arrest," said the officer to his partner. And she spent the next 21 hours in custody as part of the so-called sweeps that have reportedly lowered crime in Manhattan by almost 40%. Now, the fact that complaints are up 56% in the same period is widely attributed to whining would-be criminals. Now, my friend Marlene is a black lawyer in her 40s, with no record of any sort, yet what she found most remarkable in the experience was the police's persistent disbelief that she was who she said she was, their refusal to believe that she hadn't done something. Now, I know we're not supposed to argue with success, so just let me wonder what would happen if the police swept the lower half of Manhattan nearly as assiduously as they do uptown. Could we get an 80, 90, perhaps 100% reduction in crime if we searched the cavities of every stockbroker who runs a red light down on Wall Street or of every Dalton debutante with an open container? Do we dare to dream? So I guess I wish we could take this kind of incredulity about criminality on the one hand and this habitual suspicion on the other and swirl it around more evenly. In an ideal sense, in a jurisprudential sense, a habit of healthy disbelief should be the ethical outgrowth of innocence until proven guilty. But in this climate of wildly sensationalized, who'd have thunk it, but didn't you know, we are instead reduced to little more than high or low class suspect profiles whose day in court is not nearly as civically engaging as our 15 minutes on Jerry Springer. I want to be clear, I'm not questioning whether there is one scientific reality out there. Black, white, rich and poor, we are in this bucket together. Rather, the question is whether we know it. I have another friend, a law school classmate of mine, named Deborah, who was arrested in Chicago about 6 months ago. Now, personally, I think Deborah, like my friend Marlene, whom I have known since we were both students some 25 years ago, is about as unlikely a suspect as you could find. After all, she is also a law professor, a commercial law expert, the co-author of a textbook in contract law, and to top it off, a grandmother. But here's how it happened. She was sitting in her car at a gas station when out on the street she saw two policewomen searching a car and patting down two girls and two boys who appeared to be Latino. As she put it, "My son, who wears his hair in dreadlocks, was stopped on his way back to school after spring break because the light was out over his license plate. I didn't know why these particular kids had been stopped, but I thought it didn't hurt to sit there on private property. But one of the policewomen saw her looking, came over, and ordered her to leave. As she put it, I said very politely, I'd rather not." A second cruiser was summoned, and Deborah was taken from her car, handcuffed, driven down to the station, and chained for hours to a bench, very much like Jennifer Lopez, apparently. She was finally released on her own recognizance at 1 a.m. with 3 charges lodged against her. The first was failing to wear a seatbelt. The car was stopped, parked, she protests. The second was described in the citation as obedience to police, in big block printing as though to underscore the heart of the matter, followed in parentheses by the actual charge, the actual statute, obstructing a driveway. The third claim was that Deborah had failed to register with the Illinois Secretary of State. At the time, Deborah, a resident in New York, was teaching as a visitor in a Chicago area university for one semester. The statute in question, one that dates back to the mid-1800s, apparently requires anyone residing in Illinois for longer than 10 days to register themselves. So you should remember this. Now, Deborah is a child of the civil rights movement who, like me, came of age in a time when court watching and arrest witnessing were considered as important civic responsibilities, as important as voting. She says, "I tried to explain to the officers why I wanted to stay and watch. I guess I badly underestimated the touchiness of the police on this subject, but I hardly thought I would be arrested just for having an opinion." Deborah paused and she told me the story and then laughed. "Oh, and then there was this really strange moment when the arresting policewoman was filling out one of several attempted reports of the incident that she completed and then ripped up. Finally, she turned to me and asked with exasperation, 'What are you?'" For Deborah has one of those visages that suggest an ethnically, religiously, racially diverse range, shall we say, of political possibility. "African American," she answered. And the policewoman, who appeared to be white, seemed incredulous and grew yet more annoyed. "What do you care what happens to Latinos?" she snapped. With that, Deborah ended her tale on a note of resignation. I decided that silence was the more prudent course. Now, about 2 weeks after Deborah was arrested, the Supreme Court of the United States handed down its decision in the case of Chicago v. Morales. In a 6-3 opinion, the court struck down Chicago's very broadly worded anti-loitering statute, allowing, as the New York Times concisely put it, police to, quote, arrest anyone who, refusing an order to move on, remained in one place with no apparent purpose in the presence of a suspected gang member. Now, it is good news, this holding, but I am also a dissent watcher, particularly when the minority is composed of consistently conservative ideologues whose members could grow under a Republican president, such as the younger George Bush. So I paid very close attention when Justice Scalia, who dissented, described his feelings from the bench. I would gladly trade my right to loiter in the vicinity of a gang member in return for the liberation of my neighborhood in an instant. Now, should Justice Scalia's view ever become the law of the land, rather than just practice, however prevalent, perhaps then it will become clear what is at stake when we do not care about Latinos, about poor African Americans, and about minorities who may one day find themselves in the majority. For the right to loiter is also the right to stand in one place and just be. It is the right to look and to listen and to witness. When we trade away that right, we effectively relinquish the ability to disagree in an orderly, political, and public manner. If indeed Justice Scalia's neighborhood is ever so liberated, I hope that he, and that we all, do not find ourselves regretting what has been purchased by such loss. One of the most troubling parts of Scalia's pronouncements is that it doesn't address little matters of who gets defined as a gang member, nor does it specify the point at which we might consider ourselves sufficiently liberated to allow random meandering on the public streets again. I guess I can't help thinking of the town of Littleton, Colorado, that very wealthy community that many would assume is pretty gang-free. Yet in the wake of the horrific events at Columbine High School in May of 1999, it might be fruitful to rethink what makes some people look so dangerously suspect, no matter how exemplary their behavior, while others bask in such benefit of the doubt that they can, quote, con others literally to death. The Village Voice ran a story on its cover a few weeks ago in which it polled police officers in New York City for their sense of what the well-dressed young suspect would be wearing and thus ripe for arrest. Baseball cap at any angle, though particularly backwards. Hood, either sweatshirt or zipped up. Do-rag in particular. Baggy pants, boxer shorts, and high-top sneakers. These are effectively the kind of clothes sold at Bradley's, at Kmart, at Old Navy, affordable, well, yes, even cheap clothes, the kind of clothes that are sold in poor neighborhoods, neighborhoods where literally no other styles are available. Now, I don't presume, again, to offer this as any kind of explanation or comprehension of the madness in Littleton, but here are a few things that I will say. First, if gang members are often thought to identify themselves by wearing uniform clothing or headbands or tattoos, then Columbine High School must have had a ton of gangs, particularly if one thinks of gang colors as a kind of brand name. Indeed, the so-called trench coat mafia seemed to be the only group at that school untethered to a corporate logo. The whole school seemed divided not just by personality or activity like athlete, but each group was clustered around a brand name like pathetic little territorial flags, the nation state of Gap over here, the empire of Abercrombie and Fitch, the tattered loincloths of the low status Kmart tribesmen, the Timberland types, and the Tommy Hilfigers. Now, again, not that this is a shallow matter of social demarcation. One must consider the complications of Tommy Hilfiger alone, a white designer of colorfully preppy Ralph Laurenish clothing who became wildly popular among black teens. So many black kids tried to style with Hilfiger's increasingly oversized logo that soon it became known as a black label, at which point, of course, it enjoyed renewed popularity among young white men hoping to look like rap stars. Now, this is the sort of thing that has prompted some analysts to speak of the need for school uniforms. Now, while I don't think uniforms will get at the underlying status anxiety, when listening to those legions of traumatized adolescents speak, as though with designer clothing they had bones, volume, presence, one definitely got the urge to wrap them all in sackcloth. There was a chilling Amityville horror sort of conformity to their corporate allegiance that reminded me not so much of other recent school shootings as of the 39 middle-aged, mostly white, clonish computer wizards of the Heaven's Gate cult. Do you remember them? The ones who committed suicide wearing purple shrouds and new black Nikes. And Nike, I recall, issued a weird but very legalistic statement disclaiming any role in the suicide pact. It was such an odd touch, those sneakers. Nike is so hyped as the brand of choice for inner-city youth that its name has become almost synonymous with thwarted black male aspiration, broken hoop dreams of dribbling one's life course into alignment with a multi-million-dollar contractual rocket ship headed for the golden ether of some outer space. Young black men found dead are almost always imagined to be wearing Air Jordans on their splayed, helpless, and upturned feet. Now consider the implications of this fashion sense in another context. Consider federal district court judge Stanley Sporkin's ruling a couple of years ago, striking down State Department so-called profiles of foreign visa applicants that were actually based on skin color, ethnicity, looks, speech, and remarkably enough, fashion sense. Judge Sporkin struck down State Department guidelines that explicitly encouraged, quote, special handling of those from black areas and of those with Arab, Chinese, and Korean surnames. The guidelines suggested abbreviations by which to sort applicants such as RK equals rich kid, LP equals looks poor, TP equals talks poor, LR equals looks rough, TC equals take care. The more dutiful consular agents justified rejection of applicants with such additional notations as slimy looking, wears jacket on shoulders with earring, and no way, poor, poor, poor. Now, perhaps this example of the State Department's bias is one to which we Americans, Fox smart, self-taught, terribly insecure, may be peculiarly susceptible. We are afflicted with a class-jumping hypervigilance of the embarrassed former peasant, trying to suppress the truth of exuberant family origins, when sometimes what is at stake is not a broken rule of etiquette, but an entire sense of belonging in a yearned-for world. And the ritual dismissiveness of those beneath on the social ladder, however defined, too frequently mirrors the internalized admonishment of the anxiously newly arrived, right fork anxiety, left foot in mouth, the merciless rush to judge others because one's own humiliation is preordained. The self betrays the self when trying hardest, for the real rules are so silent, so thoughtless, small as a detail, an earring, an inflection, yet a matter of birthright, imparted in the nursery, hoarded till the grave. And I cannot help thinking of the instruction given to now over 5,000 young men in New York by 100 black officers and law enforcement on how to behave when arrested as a kind of new age debutante training, how to present oneself to society in this a more violent world. But this kind of race and class consciousness, I think, is troubling not only for its overtness, but for its insistent orderliness, its authoritarian demand of obedience, ultimately. It is troubling precisely for the polite cleanliness of its cruelty. And as Americans, we did abandon much of the sycophancy of European social hierarchy as a constitutional matter. But I worry that race has always been the great stumbling block to our most perfect union. And ever since the outlawing of explicit racial discrimination, economic classification has reemerged as a kind of handy cipher for race, for ethnicity, for all manner of historic shortcoming. We are, I believe, still a nation in which so many of the right things count. The rules for entry into most ordinary social realms are not unduly layered with arcane gestures of empty courtliness. But I think that the ongoing imperative of the civil rights movement urges us well beyond the abolition of Jim Crow. And as we reconstitute ourselves into a new global, economic, what some have called nobility, we must be mindful of the mannerist's protean capacity for a barbarian's hoard of resentments.
You're listening to Voices of Public Intellectuals with Patricia Williams.